It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the 2020 census starts exactly a year from today, and there's a lot on the line when it comes to representation in Congress. We'll find out what's at stake and how one question could shake things up. Right now, it's the first Monday of the month, which means it's time for Mondays with Mike. Each month, Wisconsin Public Radio's director Mike Crane or content director Mike Arnold joins us either on Central Time or the morning show to discuss the latest on WPR programming and operations and take your questions. Mike Crane is here with us today. We're going to talk about some special programming coming up in April, upcoming listener events around the state, and more. And we want to know what's on your mind at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what we do and why we do it at Wisconsin Public Radio? Is there a show or kind of show you want to hear on WPR? What do you want to hear more or less of? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Mike Crane, welcome back.
Always good to be here.
Well, we're going to start with an update on a big studio overhaul here at our Madison headquarters. So in addition to Mike, our chief engineer, Brittany Williams, is joining us for a few minutes. Brittany, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Mike, let's start with you. Give us some background on how this big project came to be.
Sure. One of the things that happens with any set of technologies is that when something really new and great comes along, typically you add it. So, for instance, when we had new software that we could use to connect your calls when you're calling into the show, we got that and we added it on. Over time, that meant that we had layers and layers of technology from different eras. And so for the last couple of years, we've been looking at a real refresh of the whole set of technologies in our studios. And we're always engaged in multi-year planning. And finally, we arrived at having some funding that we received from UW-Madison, our new home, that helped us to get some of the gear in place. Then we have to put it in. And so we're doing a big refresh of all of the studios and modernizing it all at once, which you think is going to really make a big difference. Although, you know that idea, like if you have a string on your sweater and you pull it, I wonder what happens when I do this? We've had a little bit of that happen, which is why people maybe have heard my announcements about occasional technical challenges.
I'll still get to keep my little Morse code transmitter, right?
That's right.
That old technology gets to stay with me. Now, this is where you come in, Brittany. The heavy lifting started, what, a few weeks ago, a month ago now? What's going on?
Yeah, so we... Our headquartered studios in Madison is the central point of distribution for the three statewide networks. And we have regional studios all over the state, but the network audio, this show, Central Time, is on network, goes out leaving from Madison. So there's a lot of equipment located in Madison in what we call ROC, Radio Operations Center. It's a room full of racks of gear. If you could imagine something, it looks kind of like a data center. Well, it had to move away from the studio site location to a new location separate from the studios. And that wasn't the plan. It was a development along the way. We realized throughout the planning process that the floor in our studio location couldn't support the weight of the new equipment we wanted to install. So we found a new home for our operations center. And this is like, it's like doing brain surgery. It's moving the brain of WPR from where it's always been, or at least in recent memory, to a new location just a few blocks away. It's not very far, but that's a lot went into that. And so we've been planning for over a year. We pulled the trigger and did the physical moving at the tail end of February, finishing up right before that March pledge drive started. And since then, we've been sort of going backwards and cleaning up some of the messes, fixing some things we broke along the way, and sort of learning how the new system works and documenting it all, and trying to get better, cleaner sound out to the listeners. And it's still a work in progress. We are by no means done.
Right. I mean, I'm in a different room right now than I usually am. The other network is to, while the serious work goes into those new studios or the old studios, making them new. Talk about what listeners are going to get out of this, the Madison part of this, and then this goes on to the other bureaus around the state.
It does. This is the beginning of a multi-year project that fundamentally upgrades the entire backbone of this operation, starting starting in Madison. As you said, you were in a what I call a temporary studio. We moved the Ideas Network and we moved the News and Classical Network away from their sort of permanent homes. And they're sitting in temporary setups right now on a bunch of repurposed old desks from offices.
My old desk, I think.
instead of studio furniture. This was done in order to allow construction in the permanent rooms themselves. I expect that we will be moving you back into your permanent home with your new equipment, your permanent furniture, around the end of June. Mm-hmm. That's phase one. Then we continue and we continue. And all of this is so that the new equipment is 100% digital. It's not just a digital console with analog wire, analog switching, which is what we've had for many years. Cause everyone has been saying digital upgrade for, you know, it feels like decades now. I'm not sure. This time it truly is digital from your console in your studio to the point of distribution where it leaves to go to the rest of the state. That's a big change. And what that means is higher audio quality. We can already tell that just with the new equipment, the sound is cleaner and also flexible ease of use. If you want to pick up and go on the road, or there's breaking news or another sort of breaking news like the Superior Fire last summer disaster happens in the state, we can react much more quickly from anywhere. I can now change the sources on your console from my cell phone.
Fantastic. Brittany, I look forward to the final project, and I want to keep you from working on it any longer. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thanks, Brittany.
Rob.
That's Brittany Williams, Director of Core Engineering at Wisconsin Public Radio. We talked with her about our studio rebuild plan. Mike Crane, WPR Director, stays with us for Mondays with Mike. Exciting stuff going on there, Mike. I'm sure we'll be checking in on this in the months to come. I want to turn to some other stuff now that we've got going on. Election Day. Let's start there, because it's tomorrow.
It's tomorrow. We have our spring election, and the big statewide office that's under consideration is the Supreme Court. So we've got some great stuff we've been doing. We've done profiles that you can listen to online. We've done interviews with the Supreme Court candidates, and that's all available on WPR.org, including the section that's /Central Time.
And we've got WisconsinVote.org. And then coming up next week now, that's tomorrow is the election. A week from tomorrow, the State of the Tribes address next week. Talk about that. We stream this at WPR.org, I think, every year, Mike.
Yes, we do. And this is a really neat event. It's going to be a speech, in this case, from the chairman of the Oneida Nation, Chairman Tahasi, and he'll be Tahasi Hill, that is, and he delivers the address. And the event is an idea to bring together the Indian or Native American nations and the government, their governments, and the government of Wisconsin to have discussions about their relationship and what are the mutual government interests between the tribes and Wisconsin. And then on Central Time that afternoon, we'll be talking about that address and having some of the highlights from it.
Again, that's Tuesday, April 9th, streaming at WPR.org at 1 o'clock. Staying with special programming, Mike, this one sounds interesting. Ask a Legal State, a national conversation about pot coming up later this month.
Yeah, we don't normally do a live call-in about a news item on the weekend, but Saturday, April 20th at noon, we're going to have experts from some of the states that have changed their marijuana laws, and they'll be available to have a conversation with other states. More than 20 states have legalized medical marijuana. At least 10 are considering legalizing recreational weed, as we've called it over the years. And Ask a Legal State is a national call-in to get the opportunity to talk about that with people around the country.
It's the April edition of Mondays with Mike. WPR Director Mike Crane is with us talking about the latest happenings with our programming and operations here. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what we do here at Wisconsin Public Radio? What do you want to hear more or less of? What kind of issues are you important to you out there you'd like to hear addressed on the show? Or do you have an issue with us you want Mike to address right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're talking with WPR Director Mike Crane during this April edition of Mondays with Mike. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for WPR's boss about what we do here? Anything that's striking you about what you're hearing that you like, dislike, somewhere in between? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. We'll start with Mark in New Berlin. Mark, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I've been a longtime listener to NPR. I generally like your programming. But for 2 years, I've been hearing a lot of people speculating about everything that's going to happen because of the Mueller report. And they have people on for an hour or half hour that don't have anything to say outside of their own speculation bias. And I'm wondering, now that the report, at least the summary, is in, I don't hear people talking for a similar amount of time or any significant amount of time about the fact that there was no collusion. And I think that shows a bias on NPR's
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mark. I know that one of the things that is a huge challenge for broadcasters is when news is unfolding. And as you know, you've pointed it out, the Mueller investigation has been unfolding for what feels like forever. And so one of the things I think about is there's this idea that the news is the first rough draft of history. And we might stick with the rough part in some cases. And you're right. A lot of times what they had to report on was speculation. And as soon as the Attorney General releases the redacted report, which it sounds like it could be any day now, he definitely wants to do it in April, there should be a refreshed set of reporting and discussion of all the different parts. And so I think we can look forward to that. In the meantime, while we're waiting, it probably is more speculation about what might be there. And I understand your comment about bias. I do know that the concept and what we try to work on at NPR and here locally is to bring on all different kinds of sides about a story so that we can decide as listeners for ourselves what we think the truth is. And that's sort of a basic tenet of the Ideas Network is to have the conversation as the news of the world unfolds.
Mark, thanks for that call. And I can mostly speak for what we did on Central Time. We had a few conversations after the four-page summary came out. And one you might be interested in on Thursday actually is with a journalism professor who says the media did too much speculating and he went across the partisan spectrum, too much speculating in the absence of information. I think that was on Thursday. So check that out. Thanks for that call, Mark. We'll go next to Scott with us in Windsor. Scott, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It's great to connect with you. One of the things that I've been privileged to experience during this transition that WPR is undergoing is when the technical glitch arises and the local WPR news update or whatever, if I'm listening to, say, All Things Considered, there's this wonderful musical feed that comes from the national network, I presume.
Yeah, that's right. In many cases, it is the national, although we do some of the same thing, you know, between the segments of Central Time. There's an old history about this. Going back to the beginnings of All Things Considered, when they had, you know, very few employees and sometimes had long segments of music as a matter of course. If anyone remembers the scene in broadcast news where they've got the videotape and they have to run it into the control room and hope that it gets on time, the same thing happened early on at All Things Considered. And so some of those music segments actually became nicknamed buttons, by which they meant, push the button, push the button. So the idea was that they could play music while waiting for that, in that case, reel-to-reel to, you know, pre-digital era or some kind of a tape being run into the studio to get it put on. And it turned out to be a really kind of a nice texture, and it became institutionalized in public radio generally that we have a button to push that has some music bed or something like that that can carry us for maybe that hopefully last 5 or 10 seconds, but sometimes a little longer.
Thanks, Scott, for that call. And that reminds me when I started here, and for a long time, our backup music here was a Dave Brubeck CD. And so anytime you were listening to WPR and you heard Take Five, come on, you knew something was you knew something was wrong. So I referred to the Dave Brubeck CD of Doom back in the day. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Oh, there's a note. Scott was also saying he had trouble picking up the Ideas Network live stream.
Yeah, we did. Is in the midst of all these technical difficulties, we did have some problems with the live stream, which is in a way just another station, if you will. And I think they're all fixed, but if you're still having trouble, definitely be in touch with the audience services folks. Most everybody could email. It's listener@WPR.org and send them a note with exactly what you're experiencing, and then we can try to figure it out.
And their 800 number, I should just have this, 800-747-7444.
Yeah.
Does that sound about right?
Sounds right.
That definitely the place to report difficulties with any form of transmission at WPR, electronic or otherwise. We've got some other special events coming up, Mike, including some listener appreciation events around the state. What do we got going on?
Oh, these are just so much fun. They're just staff meeting with listeners in their area for a free event in an interesting place. So the first one this spring summer is in Milwaukee on May 4th. We'll be at Havenwood State Forest. La Crosse, May 9th at the La Crosse Distillery. We'll be in Appleton on May 16th at Riverview Gardens, and in Merrill at the Sawmill Brewing Company on June 15th. And also, Larry Mueller is going to return to Bayfield for Bayfield in Bloom on May 10th. It's not a listener appreciation thing, but there's an opportunity for appreciation that happens. And we've got that all lined up at WPR.org/presents. And so you can take a look there and see what's the one that is near you. And we do ask you to register. It is free, but that way we can have a good sense of who might be coming in terms of the numbers of people.
Talking to Mike Crane, Wisconsin Public Radio Director, for this month's edition of Mondays with Mike, catching up on what's going around WPR and taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. William is with us in Oshkosh. William, hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can, yeah, go ahead.
Hi, so my question relates to the interview or audition process for getting a show on WPR. Some of my friends have dabbled in podcasting, and they'd love the idea of getting on public radio.
Yeah, well, sure.
Well, I won mine in a poker game, but how do people usually do that, Mike?
Is that how you got here? One thing that happens is we're receiving essentially audition tapes. They're usually a file nowadays, but we call them tapes still, old-fashioned folks that we can be. And so if a friend has an idea for a podcast that they're already doing, they could send a note to us and encourage our program folks to listen. The practical challenge we have is that podcasts typically don't have some of those broadcast requirements, like hitting a certain length of time and so on. And so since we're so fully engaged in doing the shows we are already, it's tough for us to take on more. And we want to, and so we're trying to figure out where to find the resources to find the next great podcast ourselves. You know, we have our WPR Politics podcast, which is probably our most prominent that has the word podcast in it. You can actually listen to this show and pretty much all of our shows on the Ideas Network as an archive or a podcast in that sense. And to the best of our knowledge, is doing pretty well with their national podcast. Beta, it's also on the weekends. I think that's starting to grow. So let us know. And you can send it through listener@WPR.org and they'll get it to the right person for taking a look at that. And as I say, it will be a tough row to hoe just because of all the resources we're already expending.
William, thanks a lot for that call. We heard from Rad in Minocqua, who wants to know how we pick authors to speak on the Ideas Network. He says it seems like the different shows interview the same guests, and it would be great to have more local Wisconsin writers on. I know sometimes we end up having the same guests, not as the other Wisconsin-produced shows, but we might have the same ones as, and then find out 1A is doing it the next day.
Yeah, it is a challenge. And of course, the publishing companies have their authors always doing kind of a road show. They don't literally have to come here, which is an advantage. We can have them on the phone or in another studio, pretty much anywhere in the world where they can get to a studio. And yeah, it's a coordination challenge. What you hope is that the people preparing the interview will get something different out of the conversation, and that will at least advance it in some way. We do try to coordinate, but it is definitely challenging, especially with the national shows that it sometimes is hard to get any information from them in advance.
And we do have a bias toward Wisconsin authors. We do try to get them when we can. And for a while on Central Time, Mike, we were bringing on fiction authors from around Wisconsin. We don't do as much of that anymore, but there's definitely room. There's a lot of great authors from around the state, so there would be room for more of that. Thanks a lot for that, Rad. Pledge drive we had, Mike, and it went pretty well.
It did. We were just really pleased that we received contacts, new and renewing, from 2,400 members, and they donated more than $440,000, and it was great. 500 of those are brand new members to WPR, so we were thrilled to find them. And as we often talk about, this is listener-supported public radio, and more than 40% of our support comes from people like you. So it's a crucial part of our being able to provide Wisconsin Public Radio's networks to you.
In our last couple minutes, Mike, an event we've mostly been focusing on April, but I want to put this on people's radar. Coming up in June, the Simply Folk Shindig, celebrating Simply Folk's 40th anniversary. What are we doing?
That's right. We've had a couple of shindigs over the last few years. This is a big one to mark the 40th anniversary. This one will be June 7th. Shannon Hall on the UW-Madison campus, and Dan Robinson will be welcoming Grammy-nominated musicians Dom Flemons and Mary Gaucher, along with Madison favorite Chris Plata. And we're looking forward to a great time. That'll be on stage, but it's a party, and we really look forward to that. June 7th, the Simply Folk Shindig.
All right, Mike, any last thoughts before we let you go and hit, like you mentioned, one of those time posts we have in radio?
That's right. I just want to mention again, we touched it briefly, wisconsinvote.org is our website with Wisconsin Public Television, where you can find out where to go vote, what about the candidates and all of that. And since the spring election is tomorrow, it's a great time to go to wisconsinvote.org.
Mike, thanks. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks.
That's Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. He joins us the first Monday of the month, either here on Central Time or on the morning show, to talk about the latest on WPR programming and operations. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about some of the possible political changes that could be on the way after the 2020 census, which starts a year from today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow is Election Day across Wisconsin. We'll find out who's putting money behind the candidates for state Supreme Court justice. First, today is Census Day, and that means we're officially 1 year out from the start of the 2020 census. A lot of the focus so far has been on whether the census will have a question about citizenship. But there's also a lot at stake for political representation in Congress and what the Electoral College will look like starting in 2024. Emily Badger writes about urban policy for The Upshot at The New York Times. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy Census Day.
Yes, we're all celebrating, really. Now talk about how the census, this count of all or as many of the people as they can count in the United States, translates into how many congressional representatives each state gets.
So the 435 seats in Congress that get divvied up between the states are divided based on what the Constitution requires as an actual enumeration of all of the people who are living here. And so this is the fundamental reason why the census exists. Today, the Census Bureau asks lots of other questions. Are you a renter? Are you a homeowner? What's your race? Who else lives in your house with you? But really, at the end of the day, the whole point of this exercise, as it was originally envisioned, was to collect the data that makes it possible to apportion Congress and ultimately to apportion other political seats within state legislatures and things like that. So, you know, that is kind of fundamentally at the end of the day what this exercise is about. And it's also what we're fighting about in this legal battle over the citizenship question.
Yeah, we'll get into that citizenship question because that could have a big impact on that overall count. But that 435 number you mentioned, no matter how much the population of the United States goes up or which state it's in, That is the magic number. That's how many representatives we're going to have. It doesn't go up with our population at currently, right?
Right. And so every 10 years after the decennial census happens, we go through this exercise of reapportioning that number. And invariably, you know, a couple of states lose a congressional seat or two, and as a result, they also lose an electoral vote attached to it. A couple of states gain it. You know, there are these kind of big demographic patterns that have been playing out over the last several years where, you know, the Sun Belt is growing, a lot of Midwestern and Northeastern states are shrinking. And as those population shifts happen, political power shifts a little bit. So, you know, we are expecting, regardless of what happens with the citizenship question, that a handful of states are going to either lose or gain a seat in Congress after the 2020 census, just as a result of population change.
So who is looking at gaining seats probably after the 2020 census?
Well, so there are some big growing states that we expect that are going to gain seats, like Texas, Florida, North Carolina, Oregon are probably going to gain a seat. Some Midwestern states, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Minnesota, are probably going to lose one. And again, that's sort of part of this longer-term pattern we're talking about of kind of people moving to the Sun Belt and a lot of Midwestern, Northeastern states sort of shrinking. So those are some of the baseline expectations that we have before we even get into talking about what counting immigrants has to do with all of this.
And this doesn't just affect seats in Congress. The seats in Congress also translate into, well, the seats in Congress plus two translate into electoral college votes.
Right. The number of votes that each state has is this, you know, very simple equation of the two senators that you have plus the number of congressional seats that you have. So, you know, there's power in a lot of different ways riding on the line for states in this. And, you know, for that reason, there are demographers sitting in state governments all around the country who are trying to do population projections in order to figure out, you know, what is going to happen? Are we going to lose power? Or are we going to gain power? Are we going to sort of hold where we are?
Talking to Emily Badger from the New York Times about the 2020 census, which kicks off a year from today, and the impact it could have on politics around the country, and this question about citizenship. Emily, sum up some of the controversy behind this citizenship question on the census for us.
So it is really remarkable that we are less than a year out from the Census Bureau starting to count people, and we are still debating whether or not this question is going to be added to the census. Because normally, you know, the Census Bureau does all kinds of tests. Anytime they talk about changing even the slightest thing in the census, there's lots of hand-wringing and modeling and analysis. But here we are less than a year out, and the question at issue is fairly straightforward. It's, is this person a citizen of the United States? And the Trump administration would like to add that question to the census, and a whole host of groups, including a number of Democratic-leaning states, a bunch of local cities, some immigrant advocacy groups have filed a whole raft of lawsuits challenging that, because their primary concern at the end of the day is that this question is going to discourage people in immigrant communities from participating in the census. I mean, a lot of people already feel somewhat nervous about giving the government information about them. Households that have undocumented immigrants in them, I think, are particularly likely to be afraid of that process. And so the concern is that by adding this question to the census, we're going to discourage a lot of people from participating. And, you know, we're not going to equally discourage everyone from participating. We're going to specifically discourage certain groups from participating. And so that means, in terms of talking about political power or federal funds that are also doled out based on the census headcount, that communities, states, cities that have a relatively high number of immigrants in them stand a greater chance of being undercounted and of sort of losing some of their political power as a result of that.
So for the way those votes are apportioned, the congressional seats, the electoral college votes, are non-citizens counted by the census factored into that divvying up?
Yes. Everybody who lives here is counted in that divvying up, whether you are a child, an adult, an immigrant, not an immigrant, whether you are here legally or not. The Constitution is fairly sort of clear that in an actual enumeration, we are just counting all of the bodies. We are not only divvying up political power to people who have a right to vote or who are of voting age.
And Republicans have raised concerns about that, right?
Yeah, so their concern is that this system sort of biases political power in favor of places that have a lot of immigrants in them. So, you know, the state of California has a very large immigrant population, both documented and undocumented. And as a result, they get sort of proportionately more political power than the state of Louisiana or the state of Michigan, parts of the country that don't have very large immigrant populations. And in aggregate, that sort of means, you know, there are blue states that are benefiting from this and red states aren't. There are big cities that are benefiting from this and more rural communities are losing out as a result. So conservatives argue that the system that we are currently using and that is used by states in order to proportion state legislatures as well, that it's really favoring cities, kind of urban areas and more liberal leaning places at the expense of rural and conservative communities.
What would be some of the impacts of making that change of only counting? Or actually, let's back up. What would it take if someone wanted to say, okay, congressional seats are only allocated based on voting citizens in the country?
So if we only allocated it based on people who are actually citizens, and, you know, this is somewhat what President Trump suggested in his tweet this morning that he thinks should happen. California would take the biggest hit. You know, California, based on what we think we know about the immigrant population there, would probably lose about 4 seats that would get distributed to other parts of the country. You know, it would get distributed to places like Michigan, Minnesota, Colorado. Louisiana would probably benefit from that. But Texas, which, you know, a lot of people think of it as a red state, also stands to lose because there's a very large immigrant population there. Same with Florida. The state of New York would probably also lose out. But in order for this to happen, you know, if this is really the future that you would like to see, we would have to have a constitutional amendment to sort of fundamentally change the idea that we are basing congressional apportionment on an actual enumeration of the people, on counting everyone.
Getting back to this effort to put this citizenship question in the census, as you mentioned, there are court challenges. There have been a lot of twists and turns. Do we know where we are on that and how soon they're likely to resolve that?
So this question is now before the Supreme Court. They will hear oral arguments on it later this month in April, and we're expecting by June to have a decision from them. These cases have moved through the courts much faster than they normally would because the Census Bureau is under an incredible time crunch in order to, you know, go through all of the steps that they need to actually execute the census next year. So they need to literally print like the paper censuses that will be mailed to people. And so the Supreme Court said, okay, we will expedite this. We will consider this as soon as possible so that we can make a decision in time to quickly either include this question or not include this question in the census next year. So in just a couple of months, I think that that this question will be resolved.
We'll leave it there for now. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah.
That was Emily Badger, writer with The Upshot at The New York Times. She was with us today to talk about what changes are in store for political representation after the 2020 census and an ongoing legal battle about a citizenship status question on that census. Coming up, about $3 million have flowed into the race for Wisconsin's Supreme Court justice with Election Day tomorrow. We'll look at where all the money is coming from and where that race stands. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, did you spend any of your childhood Friday nights lacing up some roller skates at the local rink? It's not just nostalgia. Our guest tells us the roller rink is alive and well today. First, Wisconsin voters will elect a new state Supreme Court justice tomorrow. It'll either be Lisa Neubauer or Brian Hagedorn, both state appeals court judges right now. The winner gets a 10-year term on the bench, taking the place of Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who's not seeking re-election. The race is getting attention not only here in Wisconsin, but outside the state, with national groups spending on behalf of both candidates. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, the AP reported a few days ago that Judge Neubauer raised more than $1.7 million to Hagedorn's $1.3 million. That's through about mid-March, so money's still probably coming in. from a long perspective, Laurel, do we have an idea of how this fits into past Supreme Court races here in the state?
We do know that I don't have a direct, you know, comparison for you, say, from the last state Supreme Court race in terms of the amount of spending, but we do know that these races have been getting increasingly more expensive, as we see kind of broadly in politics, and that they're becoming more partisan in their focus, which, of course, does amp up some of the money being funneled in. I think there's kind of a correlation there.
And again, and we've talked about this again and again, but this is technically a nonpartisan seat, a nonpartisan race, and yet, right, Laurel?
Right. You know, this has been a huge theme in this race, with both of the candidates saying that they're going to be fair and impartial judges, and they're pointing to each other saying, well, I'm going to be fair and impartial, but you're not going to, and sort of pointing out any partisan affiliations that the other might have, the support that they're getting from various groups, their kind of personal history, and what that might mean for how they're going to act if they're elected to the bench.
Now, if I'm reading the numbers right, those numbers I just said were what their actual campaigns had raised. That's just part of the story. There's also outside spending in the race. What kind of players are we seeing spending on either side?
Well, we know that the Republican State Leadership Committee has given a fair amount of money to Hagedorn, a group that a lot of folks are probably pretty familiar with. Americans for Prosperity has spent upwards of $100,000 on mailers for Hagedorn. Interestingly, there have been some high-profile groups that have sat out this race that tend to back the candidate that conservatives get behind in these Supreme Court races. The Wisconsin Realtors Association actually asked for Hagedorn to return some money to him, to them rather, after some of the letters came out and blog posts that Hagedorn wrote earlier on during his law school education. So that's kind of an interesting note on a group that wasn't involved in this race. On the other side, Eric Holder's group, the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, has spent quite a bit of money on Lisa Neubauer. They've pledged about $350,000, I believe, to support her campaign.
So again, neither candidate says, I am the Republican candidate, I am the Democratic candidate, but groups with Republican and Democrat in their names definitely see them through that lens.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And that's kind of how these partisan affiliations get a little bit fleshed out, is how which groups are deciding which candidate they want to support, sort of the things that they're pulling out and pointing to in terms of judicial philosophy and the background of these candidates.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about Election Day tomorrow, the race for Wisconsin's State Supreme Court. Judges Brian Hagedorn and Lisa Neubauer both on that ballot tomorrow. Laurel, what do we know about the general turnout in this kind of race? This is the only statewide race on the ballot. There are lots of local elections, too. This isn't your presidential turnout kind of scenario.
No, it's not. We're not expecting particularly good turnout for this race. I think turnout for this type of election in the past normally hovers around kind of the high teens and 20s. For presidential elections, we're more around 70%. So obviously not as many people heading to the polls tomorrow. However, we have seen upticks in turnout over the past several years. So hopefully people kind of keep up with that trend. And even though this is a lower turnout race, we'll see more than we have in previous years. And I think it could be interesting to see how much this message of, you know, this kind of contributing to the potential balance of the court changing, that message has been sent particularly by liberals as this race has evolved. And so I'm interested in seeing if that message has resonated and sort of really clicked with voters, and that this is an important election for the future of court in the state.
Let's talk about that balance. What is the current state of affairs on the court?
So the current balance of the court is 4-3 with a majority of conservative affiliated judges. So what happens in this case, the justice that's being replaced is Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who is affiliated with liberals. So if the liberal-backed candidate Lisa Neubauer wins, that balance stays the same. If Brian Hagedorn wins, the balance shifts from 4-3 to 5-2. What is particularly compelling to folks as they've talked about this race is this could set up the next Supreme Court race in 2020 to shift the balance to liberals if Neubauer does win. And liberals haven't had control of the state Supreme Court since 2008.
And that is the election, correct me if I'm wrong, Laurel, that would fall on the same day as the presidential primary here in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Which if there's an incumbent Republican running unchallenged and a whole bunch of Democrats, people are looking at that and saying that could be an advantage. If there's a huge Democratic turnout for that primary, that could have an effect on that potentially pivotal state Supreme Court race next year.
Absolutely. So this would be the race to reelect or replace Justice Daniel Kelly, who was appointed by Governor Scott Walker. He's a conservative justice. And you're absolutely right. People are talking about the effect of presidential turnout on that state Supreme Court race in 2020. Democrats tend to turn out in stronger numbers and higher numbers for presidential elections in particular. So folks are saying that that could be a good race for the liberal candidate, whoever that candidate ends up being in the final round there.
All right, we'll watch that tomorrow. Laurel, in our last couple of minutes, I see you've been following some of the latest twists and turns in challenges, legal challenges to lame duck legislation back in December. Some of these things might end up before whoever's elected tomorrow.
Absolutely.
What are you watching right now? You go on and do a radio show and you miss the latest that's happening.
Right. So what's happening right now is Republican lawmakers and the governor are continuing this battle over about 15 Walker appointees that the governor appointed and lawmakers confirmed during December's lame duck session. Essentially, lawmakers and the governor disagree over what a state appellate court ruling means for these 15 Walker appointees. Governor Evers says that there's nobody in these jobs right now because he hasn't appointed anyone to them. Republican lawmakers say the court ruling means that Walker's appointment still stands. So we've had quite a lot of back and forth about this. Today, the latest development is Republican lawmakers are asking that state appellate court to force Governor Evers to recognize these Walker appointments.
And these appointments, so they go back to this lame duck session. Governor Walker had made, 80-some appointments. The state Senate approved them. One of the handful of lawsuits in various courts said it all never happened. They challenged the legality, the constitutionality of the extraordinary session. A judge ruled initially with them, right? They said, yep, mm-hmm. never happened.
Yep, that's right. And that's how Governor Evers came to, get the idea that he wanted to replace these 82 Walker appointments because all of the appointments were struck down by a Dane County court. However, this appellate court has put a hold on the Dane County court ruling. So it's just it's going back and forth. And Republican lawmakers and the governor aren't on the same page in terms of what appointments are in effect and what aren't and sort of who has the authority to fill these jobs.
And theoretically, if that appeals court rules with Republicans, then the governor could appeal that again. Is that, ultimately going to the state Supreme Court?
Absolutely. I think it's inevitable that this is going to end up before the state Supreme Court. Whoever prevails in the appellate court is, whoever doesn't prevail, rather, is certainly going to appeal this to the state Supreme Court. So it's just a matter of time. And it is interesting to see, obviously the election tomorrow is going to determine who's sitting on that court and who's going to hear these arguments.
And so there was some talk about whether the new Democratic governor and the Republican legislature would be able to work together. At least with this back and forth, these are some roadblocks to bipartisan cooperation, it seems like, Laurel.
It's definitely not a harmonious sort of relationship that's being fostered and happening in the Capitol right now. This has been a really big focus of energy and action in the Capitol over the past couple weeks, all of these various lame duck decisions and how they're playing out. And meanwhile, the state is moving forward with the next state budget. Lawmakers are going to have hearings this week where they ask questions of the Evers administration on various budget proposals, how much money they need, how much money they're asking for. And so it is interesting to see these kind of high-profile clashes happening alongside the budget negotiations as everybody's talking about the need for bipartisanship there.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter. She joined us to talk about tomorrow's election for state Supreme Court justice and the money that's flowed into the race and some other issues going on in state government now. You can do some last-minute studying up for Election Day at wisconsinvote.org, read news stories about the campaign, candidate bios, and check out interviews with Judge Brian Hagedorn and Judge Lisa Neubauer. Again, that's wisconsinvote.org. It's April Fool's Day. I have no pranks for you, but at least following on social media, there's a lot of April Fools going on in Wisconsin and the worlds of politics, some institutions around the state as well getting in on the game. Here are some of the things I've seen today. I'm sure I missed plenty of them. Culver's, you know, the restaurant chain, they have the custard. They unveiled their new flavor of custard, Culver's Cheese Curd Crunch. They tweeted that with a picture. It looks like ice cream with cheese curds. And, you know, it sounds like a joke, but if you eat it quick before the custard starts to get the cheese curds soggy, I think I might eat that. I don't know. Vanilla, chocolate. I don't know. It looked like just vanilla with cheese curds in it. State Senator Jennifer Schilling said she was introducing legislation to make Euchre the official state card game. And she quoted from the book Euchre for Dummies in there. There was question that the state's Sheep's Head lobby might get in and oppose that. UW Athletics, UW-Madison Athletics tweeted this out. They are canceling the Jump Around celebration over current concerns about the seismic impact it could have. They say it could put campus landmarks at risk. Possible replacements, the Sit Around dance or the Cheese Curd Squeak Song. And then there were a couple joke articles at onmilwaukee.com. One, Michigan's governor sending a letter supposedly to Summerfest asking them to keep it down and threatening to send Kid Rock across Lake Michigan if they don't comply. Share your favorite April Fool's joke. Email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time.